basically reversed the entire election move back from November 2024. It's not a coincidence, in my opinion, but this is where Bitcoin's kind of consolidating. If I had to categorize this market, we're in a post-deleveraging reset phase. What do we see happening next? RSI has moved up quite a bit. It will make a higher low as Bitcoin makes a lower low. This is a very textbook bottom formation pattern. And so what you want to see is...
Meet Gabriel Selby, head of research at CF Benchmarks. He is specializing in institutional insights on digital asset markets.
Previously, he advised global investors at Citi Private Bank and Deutsche Bank.
One of the catalysts that we have called for in 2026 for a reason why we could see kind of a reversal in our sentiment in crypto assets is this repricing as Kevin Warsh as this huge hawkish Fed chair that's coming in. Paradoxically, I think that's actually a reason for the Fed to cut rates is because...
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today I have Gabriel on the show, recently recommended to me by somebody on X. And I thought I want to bring him on so to talk all things market and also on Bitcoin and maybe some more stuff regarding the plumbing with Bitcoin. So it's great to have you on today, Gabriel.
It's great to be here. Really excited. I think we've got a lot going on, so I hope we can fit it all in really in our window.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, let's see. So, I mean, before we start off or kick it off, can you quickly introduce yourself just for the audience so they know who they're dealing with?
Yeah, so my name is Gabriel Selby. I'm the head of research at CF Benchmarks, and we are the leading index provider in the digital asset space. We currently reference over $100 billion and digital asset products across the ecosystem. So this includes things like regulated futures, the CME platform, to the ETFs that launched back in 2024 with Bitcoin. And now we're seeing, you know, Ether, Solana, all the other ones. So we work very, very closely with institutions, and we sit in a very kind of unique spot with the intersection of the crypto native crowds and then the more traditional finance crowds. And my role as head of research primarily is to kind of help build a bridge of educational resources and marketing resources to bring these two cohorts together to ultimately scale out products and deliver access to the digital asset space.
Yeah, I can definitely recommend to see a benchmark research that you're putting out in the last couple of weeks. I was binge reading a lot of your stuff and a lot of great insights on there. I mean, you bring the institutional perspective as well, which is something I cherish. Maybe we can start there. Maybe the general read on the market, and then also what are you hearing from other institutions? You know, how are they viewing market conditions, both like macro and then also when we zoom into Bitcoin?
I think it's a really good question because there's too much going on in some ways. And to give the audience a little bit more of my background, as I started on Wall Street basically as a portfolio management function on the multi-asset space, and then transitioned over to the CIO team at Deutsche Bank as a strategist and did my stint there and really kind of cut my teeth. So my framing, when you say like we have a very institutional, approach to our research, it's because I think my background was more so in this traditional world. And so when I look at broader markets today, I look at a few things. One, there's this really dominant narrative that's been pushed through about hedge fund de-risking. And we've seen that in the 13F filings where we've seen the Brevan Howard cut their IBIT holdings 86%, and we've seen other ones like DE Shaw either trim or completely hard exit. And so I think if I had to categorize this market, we're in a post-deleveraging reset phase that really started in October 10th when we saw the largest liquidation cascade in crypto history we estimate around $20 billion of forced liquidations. And a lot of open interest was destroyed by that. So if you think about the levered market and these perps exchanges, a lot of the open interest there was destroyed. And I think the market's still digesting that. One thing that I want to kind of shift gears on is basically, what do we see happening next? What's transitioning? What are the trends? And as we're seeing kind of the fast money leaving, we're seeing some structural money arriving. So it's going to be, I think, a messy transition, but overall it's going to be healthy because we're starting to see more kind of stickier money with RIAs, endowments. We even saw Abu Dhabi Investment Corporation, a sovereign wealth fund, allocating to IBIT in Q4. And I think if I had to guess, we're just going to see more traditional wirehouses in 2026. Begin to allocate into digital assets or Bitcoin primarily. And that's going to kind of establish a reoccurring trend going forward.
I want to double click on two things that you said, you know, before we maybe then go on to like how everything is unraveling and where we're going from here. But like October 10, you know, a lot of people, when it happened, they were like, okay, this is not going to be that severe. You know, the market is going to recover. And then obviously it was right into the four-year cycle theory, you know, that it happened. And so it coincided to all fall together. And now, in hindsight, a lot of people have been arguing maybe something really broke back then, you know. And was it just market psychology, or was it something else that kind of broke? Was it a player that we still don't know of? Or do you guys have any sorts of view on this? You know, is it just a major deleveraging event, which always and obviously needs time to recover from, or what is it? Yeah.
I don't believe anything structurally broke. It's more so the natural structural shift of a Bitcoin cycle. Bitcoin trades anywhere between like a 40 to 60 annualized vol. Then, you know, we've seen that trend down over the years, but it's still very much a volatile asset. And what that entails often is, it doesn't have to, but often it entails that your market cycles are much shorter. And so we saw, you know, several bull market cycles and several bear market cycles or corrections within a traditional risk on risk off framework between equities and fixed income, which have much slower market cycles. And so to me, nothing really stands out particularly that anything's broken. If anything, it just shows that despite the grand institutional adoption, despite the fact that we have all these integrated derivatives products, whether it be covered call writing, Bitcoin is behaving very much just like it has in the past. And in fact, if you know, we do see a market bottom here, you know, at these levels, this would mark one of the lowest drawdowns in a Bitcoin bear market cycle. We typically see 70 to 80% drawdowns. And I'm not saying, you know, this is the bottom, but I don't believe anything was truly destroyed or anything's broken from October 10th. I think what it was is a structural shift in its existing bull market cycle to a bear market cycle. And if you just take the Bitcoin chart, for example, and zoom out, it's the most traditional head and shoulders pattern you'll see in a textbook, basically. Like it is the most technical textbook setup you'll see. So it's almost like a bit funny to me that we have these conversations. I mean, it's a great question, but I think it's funny how people always have to, the media always has to be like, oh, is Bitcoin really broken this time? Well, I mean, this is just the way, you know, price delivers in markets. And so it's very interesting now that we've basically reversed the entire election move back from November 2024. That's, you know, it's not a coincidence, in my opinion, that this is where Bitcoin's kind of consolidating, and this is kind of where we're chopping around. It's because this was a significant level in the previous bull market cycle, and for us to fully take out that low is going to kind of bring us to a stalling point for the bears in the meantime. I can talk a little bit about what I think is my base case, but you know, ultimately it does seem like we are going to retake the low again. So we probably will be making another low on Bitcoin in the near term. And what's interesting about that, in my opinion, is this will be the stereotypical RSI divergence low. So if you look at the RSI of Bitcoin, it's obviously was deeply oversold territory. And Bitcoin has since kind of consolidated. RSI has moved up quite a bit. It will make a higher low as Bitcoin makes a lower low. This is a very textbook bottom formation pattern. And so what you want to see is a nice V-shaped bounce once Bitcoin reclaims, retests the low that it recently made, like sub 60,000.
Interesting. And is there any timeline that you're looking to see this? Is it going to happen over the next few weeks or months? Obviously, you don't know, but like, what are you targeting in that sense?
I think it's going to happen pretty soon. There's a lot of catalysts to move volatility and to move price around right now, whether it's the geopolitical things happening in the Middle East or the market plumbing with yen carry trade dynamics. So if I had to just directly answer that question, I think it's going to be happening in the next few weeks to month.
Imagine lowering your tax bill while stacking Bitcoin. With Blockware, you can. Thanks to new tax guidelines, you can write off 100% of your mining hardware costs in a single year. Blockware's mining as a service takes care of everything, so you can start mining Bitcoin effortlessly. Visit mining.blockwaresolutions.com/LNMS and get $100 off for your first miner.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, also, you mentioned the head of shoulder correction, you know, which is sort of typical. I mean, in hindsight, it's always easy to point to something like this. I was just asking this question because back then I had the feeling in October, November, December, a lot of people were calling for the cycle not to play out similar to past cycles. And one of the arguments they were making is like, yeah, now the institutions have come in and that's why the market is different. You know, a true market mean at 80K will serve as ultimate bear market bottom, so to say, you know, just because these institutions kind of dampen volatility to the upside and then also maybe to the downside. And now it seems to have played out exactly the same again. So like, yeah, what do you say to this argument and just to people who made that argument in the first place?
It's kind of like that James Franco meme. I forget the movie, but it's like where he says same, same, but different. And it's been shared, I think, in social media. It's one of my favorite memes to send to friend groups. Most people probably won't get that joke, but it's a totally fair question. I think what I mean is that, you know, I don't think something's broken. I think Bitcoin is still a very volatile asset. And therefore, you should expect these 50% drawdowns, which is kind of where we're at right now. And where I would add the but different part is, you know, if this does create the market bottom here and we kind of see a V-shaped recovery and create a new market structure that's bullish, that takes us to new all-time highs, you know, in the next few weeks, then this would be a different market cycle compared to the past, because we've seen in the past, you really need to get into like the 80% thresholds for Bitcoin to draw down before we get to that full level of capitulation. And we look at various, you know, metrics in our indices or in our data to kind of find bottoms. And with that, we kind of starting to see a lot of these data points start to point that we are kind of building a bottom here.
You also mentioned or brought up Bremen Howard, you know, the like very famous hedge fund. And obviously, they risked quite a lot. And it was pretty much this October blow of top, you know, that appears to have triggered these systematic position reductions across these hedge funds, you know. And so, what are the sort of metrics that have prompted them to do so? The risk, was it because the basis trade was closing and it was not lucrative anymore? Or, yeah, can you speak to this as well?
The basis trade would probably be the bigger slice of the pie, in my opinion, on why we've seen the de-risking. And that's primarily due to the evidence that we've seen with basis expansion and basis compression and how that impacts fund flows. Where this pie needs to expand to some other slices is looking at kind of like value at risk breaches, but let's maybe stick with the basis trade. So basically now we've seen that the basis of Bitcoin has compressed to around the level of like T-bills. This is not a level typically that is enticing for hedge funds to lever up, go long spot, and start arbitraging futures down, which essentially is what we're talking about with basis trading. And we've done a lot of research at CF Benchmarks talking about what really drives basis trades. And when you look at the data from fund flows and leverage positioning to, you know, historical, you know, let's just call it fear greed, this tends to kind of explain, you know, when you're in kind of a positive basis environment, that you're going to see more participation coming in from hedge funds doing basis trades. On the second point, or the second slice, I would say, you know, look at value at risk. Certainly, I think that there was just a lot of blowing up with too much leverage in the system. That's evidenced by the sheer destruction of open interest, the sheer number of, you know, nominal liquidations. And that is probably not so much the Bremen Howards, but more so these other funds that are just really levered up and had to de-risk, you know, very, very aggressively and in a non-discriminant approach, which basically means get me out of my position. I don't care what price, I need out of my position.
13F filings that you mentioned, you can see it in these filings that like these hedge funds have de-risked, you know. But at the same time, I think in this article that you referenced, you were also showing, as you said it yourself, like sovereign wealth funds and other institutionals, they have still been buying. My question is sort of, it seems like the selling from the hedge funds and like this sort of complex or community has overwhelmed the still buying of like the institutions, like, you know, the sovereign wealth funds, endowments and stuff like this. But then help me understand this. How, like to a layman like me, you know, how is it possible? Because with the hedge funds, I feel like as much as I understand, they have like a short position and a long position. You know, the short position is in the futures, I guess. That's what they sell because it's higher during the basis trade. And then they have a long position in the spot. And if they unravel this, how can this have such a big impact on price if this is a neutral position in the first place? So maybe I'm getting something wrong here, but maybe you can explain this to me, because a lot of people have been saying, well, because the price has come down, it's probably the case because like these hedge funds have been selling out. And on the other side, we didn't have enough demand, coupled with like long-term holders that have also been selling. But yeah, maybe you can help me understand this.
It's really difficult to probably pinpoint exactly where on the charts, you know, this all kind of tips the scale more so to hedge fund de-risking. And I think that's certainly part of it, but we've seen also some selling across the board with OG Bitcoin holders. That was also a theme. We saw a lot of the people that owned Bitcoin for over a decade, made a small or large fortune, start to take their chips off the table. And when you think about how markets work, I think the best way to kind of understand like market making dynamics is the function is really not intended, you know, we could talk about price discovery, but it's really intended to clear price. So that means that price needs to go to where liquidity is in order for price to kind of be discovered and for it to be cleared. And the candles that we saw from October 10th and the structure that we saw after October 10th, where we just consistently saw, you know, imbalances being created to the downside. These imbalances are something that I would consider like a big candle, essentially. So just non-discriminate selling, just no bids. And every time we went into these imbalances, we respected the imbalances and we traded lower, making lower lows, lower highs. And that's the structure that really got us to where we're at. It's really hard to pinpoint, except for the fact that it's very clear from a technical perspective that there wasn't enough buying to offset the selling. And so if you were to break down the anatomy of a candlestick and look at it from, let's just say like a volume footprint pattern, you would see just so many sell orders on one side and very, very small buy orders on the other side. And that's the imbalancing that I'm talking about. It's where we start to see, you know, Bitcoin trade at discount levels or start to, you know, make a new catalyst to where we start to see that flip and the imbalances start building on the buy side, that we start to see the market structure shift into a bullish faction. So one thing that I would say about what happened and why October 10th and the hedge funds had such a significant impact on price is because it essentially kind of destroyed or completely wiped clean the entire speculative positioning layer of Bitcoin. But at the same time, we've seen how well the ETF infrastructure layer has held up. And some data that I can point to with that is if you look at the price of IBIT, you know, it's down approximately 50% from its all-time high, right? The number of Bitcoin the fund still holds. I think the number of Bitcoin that's in IBIT, it's only shrunk by approximately 5%. So this big divergence in price and the actual underlying, you know, holdings of Bitcoin within the fund. And so the market's kind of rebuilding from here. And I think it's going to be a much more structurally sound market when we see kind of that rotation from hot money to more sticky money with advisors, with RIAs, with endowments, pensions, et cetera, coming in.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Yeah, that's just amazing to see that like ETF holders seem to have like these diamond hands, you know. Like if you look at the Bitcoin itself, as you said, you know, the outflows of Bitcoin flowing out of these ETFs, it's just been de minimis, you know, which is kind of interesting to see. And so, yeah, I think I saw this post by Eric Balajunas, you know, the big ETF guy. He said something about thank your parents and your grandparents for showing like that they're true holders. And so that's kind of interesting, you know. But I mean, sticking with the basis trade for a second, maybe this is a dumb question, but I'm just also trying to think this through, you know, like how much is it the case that the deleveraging in the futures price has made holding up the spot ETF leg unlucrative, and how much of this is like a consequence of the declining BTC price, or then like the cause of it? Or is it sort of reflexive and it's kind of, we can't really tell, it's reinforcing one another, or does the question not even make sense in the first place? Yeah, maybe you can help me understand this as well.
If we just have to kind of assume that the hedge funds are rational actors, which I believe they are, you know, these are smart people that work there, is that they really do not want to put leverage and risk on. And this could be the, you know, when we say risk, you know, the basis trade by definition is kind of like a neutral position, because you're long one side, short the other. You're just kind of compressing down the spread between the futures and the spot price. But, you know, if you're in charge of delivering alpha to, you know, your boss, who's a, you know, super successful, whether you work at a pod shop, like at Point72 or Millennium, you're not really getting paid to sit there and deliver, you know, T-bill returns or treasury bill returns. You're really being driven. You're being paid to create a lot of excess returns in the markets. And so it's only when you have large spreads between the futures price and the spots that one should expect hot money to really start to sniff and look towards basis opportunities. If the basis trade, if the annualized rate between, you know, the futures price and the spot price is very significant or compressed, it's just not worth putting on the leverage. You know, there's costs to basically doing the basis trade and levering it up to grow the spread and make it very worthwhile. Because if you think about it, you're arbitraging a lot of it between the spot price and the prompt futures contract. So we're talking about, you know, rolling positions for 2 to 3 weeks, and then you have to roll them again. And if the spread's very small and you're, you know, you're leveraging up something that's, you know, oh, basically like 1 or 2% over two to three weeks, it's not too appealing. So you have to lever it up, you know, 10 times. You have to lever it up considerably to make that trade very lucrative. And as soon as that presses down, it's just operationally not worth it. You know, you still have risk operationally from executing it. And so you have to kind of consider all these things. And it makes total sense that I think we've seen that compression bring the big hedge funds that were participating out of the market. And at the same time, that's kind of capitulated into maybe the more speculative non-basis trading hedge funds that completely blew through their VAR assumptions or value at risk assumptions. And they were forced to completely, you know, delever their books.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm really not a derivatives guy. Like, I've never really had an upbringing in this, but I feel like you can maybe answer some of these questions. That's why I want to ask another question on this. You know, like, kept on hearing during the last year, because probably of these opportunities, I kept on hearing this word, harvest some Bitcoin volatility premium. And I was like, what does this even mean in the first place? You know, and then also, what are some of the ways that you can harvest this sort of volatility? And then the last question connected to this would be, and if this is done in swaths, you know, like a lot of hedge funds and companies are doing this, is this actually suppressing Bitcoin's volatility?
It's definitely, you know, real, the harvesting and the activity that we're seeing in Bitcoin markets. Harvesting vol premium means systematically selling options, whether it's calls or puts, but primarily we're seeing a lot of call selling, and that's trying to harvest the implied vol levels out to perhaps collect premiums of 4 to 6% maybe per month. And yes, you give up upside, but at the same time, you've turned Bitcoin, which is a non-carry, non-interest-bearing asset, and you've now created a very high-yielding asset. And some of these covered call funds, I think when we last looked at them, they can yield like 40% annualized. If you look at kind of the SCC data, 30-day yield annualized. So They're very high yielding opportunities. That's because Bitcoin's a very volatile asset. And to answer your question of, do you think this was compressing implied volatility? I think it did. I think it brought implied volatility and realized volatility in Bitcoin in 2025 to record low levels. And if you look at, we do a lot of interesting work with implied volatility with our CF Bitcoin, it's our CME CF Bitcoin Volatility Index. CME is actually, co-signed with us to also be a part of the name with our Bitcoin Volatility Index. But what this is essentially like a VIX, but for Bitcoin. And what we've learned with this exercise is we've basically, learned a lot about how whether speculative dollars were being positioned to hedging positions were being built on the vol surface of Bitcoin, because you have to create basically a volatility surface that shows all the expirations across Bitcoin's options market. So in this case, we use the CME options market. And when you do that exercise, you can kind of study the shifts and how the approval of covered call writing on, it was first IBIT back in, I think, fall of 2024, impacted the implied volatility surface. And what you saw was before covered call writing was green lit, you had a lot of speculative upside position for Bitcoin. So the implied volatility was skewed to the call side. Once all, products being spun up on covered call writing for Bitcoin, you've seen that compression come down on the call side. And then we've seen also put interest, so people want to hedge Bitcoin volatility, come up. And that's been very, very pronounced in the most recent sell-off. If you were to look at our volatility surface on our website, cfbenchmarks.com, you can find our Bitcoin volatility index there. You would see basically it looks like a ginormous tidal wave, and it's got, a lot of put implied volatility on one side, and it's a vertical half pipe, and then the call side's very, very small. So that's kind of like the dynamics that we see shifting from, I think, structural reasons and from sentiment reasons on what's happening in markets today.
Another question that I would have, is really like suppressing Bitcoin volatility. What I also meant, because some of the people are making this argument, how much is it also suppressing Bitcoin's price to the extent that we didn't see any blow off tops anymore? Is that a function of this sort of, we now have IBIT, we can write options on IBIT, we have more of these tools available, and that sort of makes a blow off top less likely? Is there a connection to be made there, or is that just bogus?
I think it's not entirely bogus, but I don't think that volatility within Bitcoin is entirely dead. And just because you have the ability to systematically sell the call options, and that obviously compresses the upside volatility to some degree, because what you can have is, once the trade gets to one side on the other side, you can actually flip that to be a positive kind of like short squeeze dynamic where, if everybody's selling calls and everybody's bearish, eventually, you could find a dynamic where a catalyst appears and you start to get Bitcoin buying pressure, and all of a sudden people are longing calls again, and the market makers have to basically sell calls and then hedge themselves by buying more Bitcoin. It's just, I think what happened is that there's the timing and the sequence of the market cycles where we had an incredible run up with Bitcoin price. At the same time, we had compressed volatility up until the most recent drawdown, which really, started to see capitulation levels building in October 10th and that deleveraging. I think it will change things in some degree, because we saw how as derivative markets kind of mature and enter other spaces, we saw this in equity volatility after the growth of options markets in the 90s and 2000s. But you'll still have these events where, I think Bitcoin will have its significant, right tail asymmetric pops. And it's still going to be a volatile asset. I just think there's more ways to now play this. You can choose, when implied vol is greater than relative or realized vol, it's expensive. And vice versa, when realized vol is greater than implied vol on the upside, you can probably get upside exposure relatively cheap. And I think we're in a market right now where upside exposure is probably pretty cheap, and that's largely due to the suppression dynamic that we're seeing by vol selling on the call side.
Yeah, that's one segue into macro again, because why is it so cheap currently? Is it also the case because we have just general uncertainty in the market, and it's grown with what's happening in the Middle East, and so maybe how you guys think about this, because it feels like this period now where
No, we have potential inflationary fears coming back, also with oil going to new highs. And so people are like, okay, this could potentially put upwards pressure on inflation, even though some are also arguing at some point oil with high prices is just as inflationary because it softens demand. But then on the other hand, you know, it's like also we had this NFP print, you know, coming out of the US just recently, and they were sort of bad as well. And so a lot of people are like, okay, what does it mean for the foreseeable future? We might have inflation, but at the same time, a deteriorating labor market. What will the central banks do in terms of cutting rates or leaving it at the levels they are at? So now, how do you guys think about this very complicated picture?
I love this question. I love all your questions because this is the stuff that I love to talk about. And so I'm going to, now have to figure out exactly which ones I want to prioritize. And maybe we can start with kind of the macro and geopolitical uncertainty picture overall, where you're right. We're recording this just after a very big negative economic surprise shock on the NFP report. Did not look great by any stretch of the imagination. And we know this because, one, when you see, healthcare shredding jobs, which is kind of like a more defensive, stickier sector, and you strap that along with the overall trend, when you zoom out, it does not look like, there's real labor demand in the U.S. economy. And we've been calling for that in our outlooks pretty consistently every quarter for like the past year and a half. I think we've been calling for the Fed needing to start to lower rates and prioritize the labor market in favor, of the labor market over the concerns over inflation. What you highlighted here with the geopolitical shock of the Strait of Hormuz being shut down, we got the, uncertainty about oil production out of the Middle East. Certainly this is something that would create a temporary inflationary spike, in my opinion. But in the long term, like you said, it does kind of just destroy demand because of the fact that you have increase in energy costs and increase in oil prices at the pump. And that, takes wallet share of already a consumer that's pretty much in a very sanguine, bad mood right now. So the dynamics are very different than I think the oil price shock from the Ukraine war, where the U.S. economy was still making, 150,000 to 250,000 jobs a month. This labor market's much weaker. At the same time, real wage growth is pretty weak as well. So I don't suspect inflation is going to be entrenched. And I don't suspect that the mood of the consumer is really going to shift in any sort of positive light because of these uncertainties. I follow this account called Trueflation, which has a higher frequency measure on the inflation picture in the U.S. economy compared to the BLS. I would say that it's very novel, their ideas, and there's certainly a lot of structural mistakes that the BLS does with measuring inflation. But I think what we have to do is kind of compare, how these two measures really impact the vibe of the consumer, and where Trueflation kind of shows where, the inflation rate's very low. I think they're crediting a lot of that to the shifts in rent and structural shelter costs. But I think the consumer doesn't really feel that every day because you don't buy a house every day. You don't sign a lease every day. You see, your prices of your goods at your store is always increasing. And that's really what is really, I think, dampening consumer sentiment. And ultimately, paradoxically, I think that's actually a reason for the Fed to cut rates, is because it's going to, this is really going to harm consumer sentiment and then thus consumer spending. So I know that there's, sticky inflation concerns. I know there's inflation concerns with the oil price shocks, but I still think what the Fed probably needs to do in this case is really look at the risk of what we get if we get into a recession, and what the fiscal picture looks like there when you have a bunch of unemployment and initial jobs claims spiking. That would be much more detrimental the economy, which is basically the deflationary spiral, right? We worry about inflationary spirals and we have deflationary spirals. I think we got to consider a deflationary spiral here in the economy.
No, that's certainly a good point to bring up here. I guess my question would be, or follow-up question, do you think the market is currently pricing rate cuts wrongly, in a sense of like, should it probably be more rate cuts than currently are priced? And because, like,
You know, with this NFP print that we saw, one thing that's like I noticed is like not even the bond market rallied enough, you know, on that news, which is kind of like, okay, I see the market is kind of hung up about this inflation fear. But in your view, what about interest rate cuts? I think you're alluding to it already. You feel like maybe the market is wrongly positioned there and we will see maybe some surprises as well.
We are on the side more with like Bloomberg Economics team. I think they're calling for about 100 basis points in rate cuts in 2026, mostly happening the latter half of the year. I think that's pretty fair, despite the fact that the market hasn't really caught on yet. You know, I've been a strategist for some time, and I've been following the implied rate cut path on the OIS curve for some time, and it's almost always wrong. You know, if you were to just extrapolate out, there's just too many variables in the world that are shifting. And so you kind of have to filter through the noise and see, okay, what's really driving rates right now. I think you're right. It's fair to say that, you know, there's certainly inflation concerns still on the horizon. We've seen how the tariffs have kind of impacted goods inflation. We now know that, you know, oil prices are probably going to be very high going higher in the short term. But at the same time, you know, I think there's a lot of dynamics with the technical sides of the treasury market where, you know, if you're going to war, you're probably going to spend a lot of money. And that's going to require, you know, more debt issuance. And if you see whether it's countries have starting to maybe have concerns about the U.S. leadership, start to kind of pull back investing in the U.S., start to pull back investing in dollar-based assets like treasuries, then you're going to have a technical mismatch where you have more supply coming on the market to finance debts and you're going to have less demand. And I think the market, in some ways, it's kind of like a bond vigilante dynamic is really starting to kind of show that with the yield spiking in this kind of geopolitical uncertainty regime that we're in. Ultimately, what's going to probably happen, in my guess, is that we're in a midterm election year. And it's very rare for midterm election years to have negative performance for risk assets. It's quite common that you get, you know, the administration to try to run things hot. And so one of the catalysts that we have called for in 2026 for a reason why we could see kind of a reversal in our sentiment in crypto assets is this repricing as Kevin Warsh as this huge hawkish Fed chair that's coming in. You know, he's got a lot of, I think, history that's being tied to him, you know, talking about balance sheet reduction, which is very hawkish. But if you listen to him more carefully, he's really, I think, going to surprise people on how dovish he's going to be. And once you see that kind of Fed leadership change, and if he's successful in corralling the rest of the Fed members to shift their focus on their risks and be less balanced, but to more focus on the weakening dynamics in the labor market, you'll probably see a Federal Reserve that has a monetary impulse that's inclined to run things hotter. And that could open up the door for asset purchases. We know that quantitative tightening ended in December. We're already seeing the balance sheet start to expand. By our estimations, we think that, you know, on average, we're going to get $50 billion of balance sheet expansion through the next 12 months. We're pretty close to that pace right now if we look at what's happened in the repo market. So you're starting to see this rate of change happen in the plumbing. I think it's very likely, you know, I would assume that the Republicans want to maintain control of Congress. And I want to assume that, you know, Trump will want to work with Republicans versus Democrats in the last 2 years and not become a lame duck. Then I suspect I try and really start to kind of come up with reasons to like run things hot.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it as well. I mean, you're definitely right. I mean, currently the market is really pricing this hawkish Warsh, you know, and I guess to some extent it doesn't match with what we're hearing from the Trump administration. And if they want to have their way, they're going to try at least to force interest rate lower. And so you're exactly right. We could be in for surprises when it comes to Warsh, how we will actually be steering the ship over at the Fed. But you mentioned the midterms, you know, and that's maybe one quick topic I want to pivot to as well. I mean, regulation, you know, regulatory clarity, it's been sort of a tailwind for the past couple of years, even, you know, ever since Trump got into office, everyone was so excited. And now, you know, everyone is looking to the midterms. And I think you had something in your research piece as well, where you're saying, well, the window is sort of closing of when it comes to bringing, you know, the Clarity Act to fruition and stuff like this, because it could be the case that the Democrats might be the winning party, win the Senate and stuff like this. And so Yeah. How do you interpret it? Is this an actual risk also for crypto, or do you think they're going to push it through before the midterms to evade sort of this calamity of the Democrats taking over, so to say?
It's definitely a risk, and it's being priced in by the markets. In our piece, we made the argument that you could basically extrapolate a 0% probability that Clarity passes in current pricing terms because of the fact that we've retraced the entire post-election move. So if markets rallied in November of 2024 because we had a very pro-crypto president, a very pro-crypto administration, and they were going to deliver a sound foundation of regulatory clarity for this industry in the United States, and that brought us to, you know, these all-time highs with Bitcoin trading at 126,000, and now we've retraced this back to where the same level was pre-election, you could make the case that this is pricing in at 0% probability. So if you have to ask yourself, where is alpha? Well, what if that's not true? What if it's not 0% probability? What if it's actually 80%? What if it's 90%? Now, if you look at prediction markets, it's still kind of more of a coin flip. It's much more, and you could argue maybe the prediction market's smart money in this case, and that's where you should be getting your signal from. But, you know, paradoxically, we kind of see the urgency to get this done as a reason that you should maybe assign higher probability of seeing it getting done. And in our view, we believe that it's probably going to get done between or sometime before June and July. And that's a major catalyst to look for in markets to kind of see a reversal in momentum and all these metrics that we highlight also as well for building bottoms in the markets.
Yeah, great. You as well. I want to bring this to a close, you know, but mentioned, you know, that we haven't ultimately bottomed. I guess the final bottom has not been put in. But then again, as I understand you, I think we are with Bitcoin in somewhat of a deep value territory, and it's a great spot to be maybe adding. But then, like, what are the signs and metrics that you're checking on a daily basis almost, you know, to kind of look for this final capitulation and then the seller exhaustion also? You mentioned the RSI, you know, making a lower high, I guess that's what you were saying. And so
a higher low.
Yeah.
On RSI and a lower low on Bitcoin price.
On the Bitcoin price. Yes, exactly. But like, are there any other metrics that you're checking and to kind of assess, okay, this market is actually bottoming out and then there will be strength returning?
Being in the index provider seat gives us a few advantages. If you look at how practitioners work in the equity markets, they love to study things like breadth, momentum, on a broader indices. And we've constructed an index called the CF Broad Cap Index, which is the broadest measure of liquid investable tokens for large institutional investors that could theoretically, you know, think of that as kind of like a MSCI ACWI. It's not a large cap index by any means. It has a lot of smaller cap tokens, but it's kind of like the full broad spectrum of the index universe, of the investable universe for an index. And so what we like to do is study momentum. So we look at things like the percentage of tokens that are below the 200-day moving average. Of course, that's pretty much all of them right now. And then when you get into bottom-forming patterns, we also like to look at some breadth metrics like the percentage of tokens in the index that are making new 52-week lows. And what we've seen in typical kind of bull market structure bottoms that have happened before is that every time we see about 40% of the constituents and hit new 52-week lows, that's been a sound bottom in recovery. Now, we're not in kind of a bull market structure. We're kind of in a bear market structure. So we recently saw this metric hit close to 80% with the most recent drawdown. And that tells me that we're probably getting close with signs of capitulation. This is also coinciding with things like the Bitcoin to gold ratio, where we're really getting close to that 2022 trough that we saw before, where we see, you know, this rotation from something like gold back into Bitcoin. And that's something that we're calling for as well. But we also have a lot of unique kind of quantitative factor data that's something that we have privy to. So we look at crypto factors in the same way that equity markets look at factors. So we have things like value, growth, we have momentum, we have downside beta. And what we're seeing right now is downside beta really kind of outperform. Sorry, I didn't know if you're going to jump in there.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, like, these low downside beta tokens versus high downside beta, like then also value versus sort of growth tokens. How do you define this? Is it like you're looking at the token and then you're factoring them into sort of this sector, or like, yeah, what is a low downside beta token in that sense?
Exactly. So downside beta, let me just take a step back and do some glossary work here. It measures how much an asset falls relative to its benchmark. This could be something like Bitcoin, or we could use maybe even the broader market overall during drawdowns. So low downside beta in itself is very defensive. So it means that, you know, these are the tokens that fall less in relative terms to the overall market, where higher downside beta would be, you know, tokens that have maybe more speculative narrative-driven valuations, very thin liquidity. You can think of like these lower cap L1s or L2s. You can think of like meme coins or speculative tokens that trade really on sentiment rather than any sort of fundamentals. These types of tokens tend to really, you know, capitulate. They tend to see major drawdowns when sentiment's bad. So when we construct the downside beta, it's really kind of indicative of the environment that we're in. And ever since the October 10th sell-off, we've seen how downside beta has completely like dominated our factor performance on our long short portfolio. So that means that the tokens with higher downside beta are underperforming the tokens with lower downside beta. With value, we try to, you know, assign the same equity framework that you could, you know, with, you know, value definitions and stocks, but they don't really map one to one, but the principles really still apply. So when you look at value characteristics in crypto, we really look at kind of the revenue generation of protocols. So how much real fee income does the network generate? Are these tokens trading, you know, in relative terms to that fee revenue or MEV capture or staking yield? Or, you know, you could use a series of things to basically assign a value score. And so for us, you know, we're wanting to see kind of like a rotation out of downside beta. We want to see things like value start to perform better. We want to see things like growth start to perform better. And that would be kind of a sign where we're starting to get a rotation with factors.
And out of curiosity, how do you define like growth and liquidity and momentum? Like, because just like as a layman, again, I would say each and every crypto token is sort of momentum, you know, but like, how do you find it for your factor? And then also like liquidity and growth, what's like a typical token
it's
for
tricky.
These?
No, crypto doesn't have standardized financial reporting, right?
Exactly.
That's where having, you know, experts, you know, we have a quant researcher, Christian Isaac, who's really, his entire job is building these out, researching this stuff. And we have to kind of go through and create like a transparent rules-based framework for categorizing and really defining, you know, growth. And so when you think about growth, you know, it's looking things like how fast is the revenue growing? Does it have, you know, high FDV to actual protocol usage. You look at these things that, you know, you can kind of build a narrative-driven valuation with performance metrics on the tokens. And that kind of gets you this parameter that's similar to equity markets where, you know, you see a view of adoption and addressable market fit rather than the current cash flows, like something like value, which is more assigning current cash flow relative valuations to. So this is a kind of a different view. It's more like a what could be versus what currently is.
Interesting. Yeah, that's amazing. Thanks for explaining this. Gabriel, we're 50 minutes in. I guess we'll keep it at that. That was amazing. I mean, we could go on. It was really nice also getting your succinct answers and sharp insights. So thanks a lot for that. If people want to follow you guys, how can they reach out? Where can they read about you and stuff from you? If you could let the audience know, that would be great.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Yeah, glad to plug us. It's been a really great conversation. If you want to follow along closely, go to cfbenchmarks.com and enter in your information there below. You can get all of our research, all of our publications for free. Conversely, you can also just go into the research and insights section under the blog, and you'll find all of our publications. I'm also on X. My X handle is GXSLBY. That's GXNSLBY. But feel free to tag along, and we'll hopefully be providing some good stuff in the near future. So stay tuned.
Great. Thanks a lot, Gabriel. Have a great one, and talk to you maybe in the future again. Thanks. Yeah.